chefs sang out with great joy on Sunday, November 23rd. This presented a whole new set of problems. How to get construction underway in Texas, even as the R1 refuge in Mancos was still incomplete? Warren set unrealistic deadlines, saying it was a life-and-death matter to finish the houses in Colorado by November 30th, so that he could send 4 men down to Texas to begin foundation work there. He said the workmen should not be concerned about the breakneck schedule because attending angels would be helping them pound the nails and put up sheetrock. When they were not actually building in Mancos, the chosen workmen underwent intensive new spiritual training for their sacred new calling at the Texas site that Warren was calling both R-17 and Zion. They were already loyal FLDS members and skilled workers. But now they had to be elevated to the exalted rank of temple builders, a title never before heard within the FLDS that carried great prestige as well as secrecy. With his master escape plan coming together, the time had come to slam the hammer down on his Short Creek enemies. Warren would later report that God delivered specific instructions on what had to be done during a special revelation on December 24th, the night before Christmas 2003. When he returned from Texas, he would follow those instructions and take care of one last important piece of business in Short Creek. Chapter 18. 21 Men. Warren Jeffs blew into Texas on a lie. A single entity buying more than 1,300 acres of land at once was bound to draw attention, even in rural areas of Texas. A curious neighbor who watched the new activity while leaning on the fence at the eastern boundary was told that a private hunting lodge for rich men was to be built on the ranch, and that the construction workers and their families were coming in to get things underway. The first time that Warren went walking alone on the Texas property, on Sunday afternoon, January 4, 2004, he followed a dirt track to the northeast and got lost in the sprawling, empty sameness of it all. He wandered back south and was gone for 2 hours until found by an FLDS man driving a dump truck. The next day, undertaking a wider exploration with a guide, he bounced along aboard a small and rugged four-wheeler and got a better lay of the land. Zion blazed in full glory in his churning imagination as he charted out where God wanted the temple to be built, as well as the houses, the barn, the dairy, and the manufacturing and agricultural areas. He saw deer and antelope and got the worst case of hay fever he had ever had. But he could not linger. Claiming to have an important Saturday work meeting to conduct back in Short Creek, he headed back to Mancos, Colorado, leaving behind his hand-picked cadre of 25 men, 12 women, and 16 children to start the Texas project. They would live for now bunched into a large camper trailer, a motorhome, and 4 tents. The motorhome had a bathroom, and the tent dwellers shared a portable toilet. The living conditions were really much too Spartan for a man of Warren's delicate sensibilities. An eerie scene unfolded shortly after dawn on January 10, 2004, at the cavernous Leroy S. Johnson Meeting House in Short Creek. The tall, slender prophet Warren Jeffs had arrived in the empty hall at 6:40 a.m. and was standing alone at the speaker's platform when the FLDS faithful began to show up. He was not smiling. God had finally identified his enemies and shown how they were to be handled. On this day, Warren would prove to the FLDS once and for all that it was he who held the reins of power in their lives. As usual, it was an FLDS members only affair. But over time, and through many interviews, listening to tape recordings of Warren's monotone tirade, and finally reading his own version of events in the priesthood record, I was able to piece together exactly what happened that morning, and the hazy initial reports smoothed into crystal clarity. Warren manhandled them. Dan Barlow, the town's mayor and fire chief, was one of the early arrivals at the meeting house, and he approached Jeffs and shook his hand. The prophet edged Barlow to the side and quietly confided that he had been instructed by the Lord to deliver a public correction to Barlow. The mayor could either stay in the audience or listen in private from an adjoining room. Barlow chose to stay. A number of other men received similar quiet personal warnings as they arrived with their families, and they also chose to remain in the big central chamber. The women and girls were, as usual, dressed modestly in long pastel-colored prairie dresses, and their long hair was swept up in the unique fashion that is standard within the religion, but that outsiders call a plig-do. The men and boys wore their long-sleeved shirts buttoned at the wrists and collar, for any display of skin would be frowned upon. The children were well-behaved and squeaky clean. Jeffs conducted the service with authority, reading forcefully from church doctrine that men who would spread even the least doubt among the faithful must be cast out. For an hour and a half, he flailed them in a voice that carried no more inflection than the drone of an air conditioner. One by one, he expelled 17 men, dropping his axe on many whose families had carved the town out of the wilderness before Warren was even born. He commanded everyone to rise.
"The Lord has revealed to me that these men no longer hold priesthood. They have been tested of God and found wanting, and Heavenly Father, through the prophet, will have me handle these men in order to begin a cleaning up of His kingdom before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. We love these brethren and await the day that we can welcome them back into the brotherhood of the Lord. But until they have been sufficiently humbled before God and bow before the Lord with a broken heart and contrite spirit, the Lord God will have me send them away to repent from a distance."
There was a pause as the congregation seemed to be holding its breath as they soaked up the startling decision. Warren pushed ahead.
"All those who can validate this action as the will and word of God, please so manifest by raising your arm to the square. Any in opposition may so manifest in the same manner."
Of course, there were no dissenting votes. All in attendance raised their hand in support of the prophet. Even the surprised victims reacted with reflexive obedience and raised their right hands as if swearing in court to affirm the decree. He then dismissed the exiled men from the meeting, with instructions to return to their homes and prepare to leave Short Creek as soon as possible. They accepted the abuse like meek little lambs. Among those Warren expelled were four of his own brothers: David, who was confined to a wheelchair due to polio, Hiram, Brian, and Blaine. In the complicated Jeff's family tree, Blaine's youngest wife was also his stepdaughter. As strange as it seems, that is not an uncommon practice within the FLDS. When a man is thrown out of the church, the prophet automatically dissolves all of the transgressor's previous marriages. The freed wives and children are assigned by the prophet to someone else, so new kids are frequently being brought into established families. The prophet may later reward the new father for displaying great obedience and taking on the responsibility of someone else's family by assigning one of the new stepdaughters to be another wife. The girl thus becomes a sister wife of her own mother and is available for sex with the man who is her new father. Of paramount importance for Warren on that momentous January day of reckoning was the opportunity to handle four of the influential Barlow brothers. The family, responsible for the unauthorized monument, library, and museum, was decimated. Mayor Dan Barlow is on the list. So were prominent businessman Nephi Barlow and Truman Barlow, an important figure financially within the church, and in-town tax collections and disbursements. The primary target was Lewis Barlow, age 80, who many people had thought should have become the prophet instead of Warren with the death of Rulon in 2002. Warren accused the Barlows of forgetting God by having erected monuments to man in Short Creek, constituting idolatry, and charged that they had secretly been forming a counterfeit government. They were ordered to write letters of confession, leave their homes and families, and to not come in this community until they receive permission from me of the Lord. It was the standard sentence for men and boys who were thrown out of the religion. Repent from afar. He was not yet finished, and he now instructed the entire congregation of several thousand people to kneel before him.
I raised my arm to the square and pled with the Lord to forgive these people,
he would recall later in his record of events. Then he addressed the families of the banished.
All you ladies married to these men are released from them and will remove yourselves immediately from their presence. If you don't, I will have to let you go.
Four more men also would be tossed out soon after that fateful meeting, bringing the total expulsions to 21. They were stunned. Nothing had ever happened on such a scale in Short Creek, with so many FLDS families being destroyed in one swoop. Hundreds of women and children were affected. The dumbfounded congregation was instructed to begin a 2-day fast as part of the repentance process. After a closing prayer, Warren brought the extraordinary gathering to a close and calmly strolled to the exit doors to shake hands with the congregants as they filed past. Happy to have dodged the bullet themselves, they eagerly declared their loyalty.
I love you all,
Warren assured them, projecting an image of unwavering love, keeping sweet, while having casually destroyed so many lives. The awful repercussions of that day can be measured in the suicide, death, despair, depression, misery, financial ruin, incest, and immorality that followed. The wives of the expelled men would be reassigned to other men, and their children would be forced to call a stranger father. It was all done in the name of the Lord. The political rivalry between the Jeffs family and the Barlows stretched back a long time, but the power struggle was now over. Warren believed that he had ended it by ripping the heart out of the Barlow clan, but he would continue to cut them even deeper in the months to come, vindictive in his retribution. There was no mercy, because the people needed to understand what happens to those who dared to challenge the Lord's self-anointed leader. The Barlows and the other expelled men did not recognize just how serious Warren was about crushing them. They thought their exiles would be temporary, and that after repenting for a couple of weeks, they would be allowed to return to their homes and regain their families. That was not the prophet's plan at all, and as time passed, my investigation would show that some of the women and children were handed around the priesthood like sugar candy at a party. Everybody got a turn. When the expelled Barlow men moved into a house together in another town, Warren attacked again, ruling that if they were ever to regain even the slightest chance of being forgiven by him, they could not keep each other company. If they were together, they might be tempted to commiserate about how they had been wronged and start plotting against the prophet. Once again, they blindly followed Warren's edict, obeyed his absurd rules, and separated to live alone, with no family contact whatsoever. The unrelenting pressure, loneliness, and humiliation eventually became too much for the elderly Lewis Barlow. Once considered a candidate to lead the entire religion, he now slid into depression and debt, living off his credit cards. The old man decided that no matter what had been decreed, perhaps God might accept him into heaven after all, so he took his own life. Suffering from congestive heart failure, Lewis stopped taking his medications and died of a heart attack in May, 4 months after having been excommunicated. Warren even seized that tragedy to further shame his deceased rival and the Barlow clan. He magnanimously allowed a funeral to be conducted at the meeting house and a burial in the town cemetery, but he would not allow the grave to be dedicated, a traditional and vital part of an FLDS funeral service. Jeffs claimed that Lewis had not fully repented before death, so was undeserving of his priesthood blessing. At the service,
The dead man's former wives were ordered to sit beside their newly assigned husbands. There was no longer any confusion about who was in charge of the FLDS and the millions of dollars of riches in its financial arm, the United Effort Plan. Immediately after the Saturday work meeting on January 10th, Warren Jeffs disappeared. Only 11 hours and 50 minutes after delivering his blow to Short Creek, he was back in the Moncos hideout, rushing to lead the church hierarchy into what he called deep hiding. Elderly Uncle Fred had been quietly removed to Moncos in the middle of the night, stripped of his title as the Bishop of Short Creek, and Warren instructed Fred's wives that the old man was gone, not to come back to the town. Wendell Nielsen, the old ally who had filled Warren's slot as first counselor in the presidency, would also go underground with Warren and Fred, surfacing only for special missions. Jeffs ordered his own family to scatter, and they piled into waiting vehicles and took off, destinations unknown, some joining him 5 hours later in Colorado. The only newspaper in Short Creek is an irregularly published community periodical from the church, but bigger papers had been watching and had developed sources in the town. The Daily Spectrum in nearby St. George, and the Desert News, and Salt Lake Tribune in Salt Lake City all carried stories on the meeting in their Sunday editions on January 11th. Anxious police throughout the area responded with calls to Chief Marshal Sam Roundy to offer assistance in case there was a riot. Warren sniffed at such intrusive attention by the media and the law, since he considered the political massacre to be just an internal setting in order of the people. He had dealt with the master deceivers, and everything now would be able to return to normal. That was not to be. For an insignificant Short Creek resident named Ross Chatwin had stormed into the mix. Chatwin had already been expelled for trying to take a second wife without permission, but Warren now learned that Chatwin, instead of being obedient, was fighting back. He had sent out hundreds of letters claiming that Lewis Barlow was the rightful prophet of the FLDS. This brand new enemy had come out of nowhere, and on January 14th, the impertinent man held a news conference in which he denounced Warren as a tyrant. Short Creek was invaded by the Gentiles, cops, and the media, and all of Warren's hard work to put things in order there seemed to be coming apart at the seams. Warren told his scribe, "We have no friends on earth." He canceled a plan to return to Short Creek, using the excuse that people were waiting there to kill him. Instead, he would take a road trip. Despite the heightened tension, some needs remained constant, according to his record, and Warren snatched two more children as brides, Gloria Ann Steed and Veda Keat, both only 13 years old. They were happily given to Warren by their fathers and mothers. And as the storm broke, he married two more, Loretta Jane Barlow, also 13, and Permelia Johnson, 15. In his own words in the priesthood record, Jeffs admitted to marrying four underage girls within a few days. He simply took them. No little girl in the faith was safe if the prophet wanted her. Accompanied by his wife's scribe, Naomi, and with his brother Leroy Jeffs and money man John Wayman, Jeffs took off from Moncos on Tuesday, January 27th, 2004, in a two-vehicle convoy, a spacious Ford Excursion, and a Ford Navigator. He claimed to be on another mission ordered by God, but in retrospect, it looks more like a holiday from his troubles. The little group had only traveled across the rest of Colorado and part of Kansas before Warren started making horrendous pronouncements concerning God's judgments. Naomi recorded them.
"There is such a dark spirit everywhere of great wickedness. The people on this land are only worthy to be swept off."
In the cold of winter, Jeffs tracked back to the very roots of Mormonism. Upon reaching the environs of Independence, Missouri, he stepped through a carpet of light snow and 15-degree weather to explore the place that once had been set apart as a site for a future temple by the early Mormons,
although none was ever built there. Jeffs had first seen it during a 3-month coast-to-coast trip the previous year, when he was out sizing up possible places of refuge. The site holds significance to the mainstream Mormon church, but Warren wanted to rededicate it in behalf of the FLDS. He stood tall, with both his arms held out on the square, and prayed for the Almighty to strip the land of its current population of hundreds of thousands of people, so Jeffs could build the New Jerusalem and the temple in Jackson County, Missouri. It showed an evolution in his thinking. The FLDS had always clung to the idea that they were far beyond needing anything like a real temple, because they had lost the right to enter Mormon temples when they were excommunicated a century earlier. In the recent decades, however, prophets had made reference to the FLDS still not needing any temple, at least until after the end of the world, when everyone else had perished. Warren was now seriously thinking about that. While on their trip, they also visited the Carthage Jail in Carthage, Illinois, where LDS church founder Joseph Smith had been murdered by a mob on June 27, 1844. Warren repeatedly compared himself to Joseph, even claiming that he, too, would one day be called upon to reveal ancient texts that would become canonized into Scripture. He surveyed the room in which Smith had been assassinated, saw the bullet hole in the door, and examined the window from which Smith had fallen. What image did he take away from that historic scene?
The room was quite small, he noted in what would become a persistent, peculiar refrain.
Early on the final day of January 2004, a Saturday, the little caravan crossed the Mississippi River and hurried to Nauvoo, Illinois. The early Mormons, when driven from their homes in western Missouri, had reclaimed this once swampy land and built a thriving city on it. Then it was on to Ohio, where Warren's troop did some laundry before heading to Palmyra, New York, and the hill Cumorah, where a large statue of the angel Moroni marks the spot where Joseph Smith retrieved the golden plates bearing the runes that created Mormonism. But Warren was at a loss as to why God had sent him on this particular trip in the middle of winter. Something continued to gnaw at him. Why did God and the angels and saints appear in humble surroundings? In a fit of clairvoyance and characteristic hubris, he proclaimed in the record that while God and his messengers sometimes did drop into modest places, the Lord really wanted a temple where he can appear in honor and glory to his faithful people. After that declaration of God's true wishes, twisted to fit his own dream, Warren headed back west. The breakaway religion that had prided itself on never needing a temple was about to get a monumental one. Chapter 19. There to Stay. The FLDS quest for secrecy in Texas would fail. Residents in and around El Dorado had not yet discovered the truth of what was unfolding with their reclusive new neighbors, but they did not like the rumors they were hearing. They began asking questions of Schlaker County Sheriff David Doran, an affable man of medium build with a mustache and dark hair that is usually hidden beneath a cowboy hat. He was in his third term, knew his county well, and had been carefully watching the dramatic changes at the old ranch. Among those asking were his old friends Randy and Kathy Mankin, the publishers of the weekly El Dorado Success newspaper. Few outsiders knew more about the odd goings-on out at the ranch than the unflappable Mankins. Randy was a hometown boy who had spent his younger years as a Texas oil wildcatter, a job that had taken him away from his roots. When he had had enough of the oil fields, he and Kathy had bought the newspaper and settled into what they had anticipated to be life in a sleepy small town. Then came the FLDS, and everything changed. The Success office was only a few miles from the front gate. In the months to come, Randy and Kathy would be reporting breaking news on the hottest story going.
The little newspaper with about 1,100 subscribers would regularly scoop the bigger media. The presence in town of the inquisitive newspaper ensured that there would be publicity when the mysteries of El Dorado started to unravel, which happened only 2 days before the end of February 2004. On that day, Ben Johnson, one of Warren's drivers and bodyguards, was stopped by a highway patrolman because the license plate on his vehicle was obscured. When a bloodied arrow was discovered, Johnson said he had been out hunting, and the patrolman summoned game wardens who insisted on seeing the dead deer. Johnson had to take them onto the Zion property, where the visitors were surprised by the scope of the construction that was underway. Three multi-story wooden buildings were going up among the scrub trees, and cargo storage containers littered the area. Warren instructed presiding elder Ernest Jessup, who was in charge of the compound at the time, to lie and stick with the fabricated cover story. Jessup told the authorities that the workers there were merely an out-of-state construction crew building a private corporate hunting retreat. The materials in the big storehouse where the deer had been taken held food and other supplies for the crews and their families, he said. The game wardens took Ben Johnson, the archer, to court, where a $200 fine for poaching was levied by Justice of the Peace Jimmy Doyle. The fine became a minor issue when Doyle declared that he was very familiar with the property. He was the pilot of a Piper Cherokee 180 airplane that frequently flew overhead, keeping a distant eye on them. Doyle had dug up information about unlicensed refrigeration and freezer rooms. Johnson quickly obtained the needed permits and headed back to the ranch to report. The private hunting lodge was not going over with the locals, and before long, Warren told his scribe,
"The government officials of that county, Schlaker County, know of us."
Early in 2004, the prophet and I were finally starting to cross paths. While Jeffs was planning Zion, I had just started working for Ross Chatwin, hoping to help him keep his house in Short Creek. Within a few more months, I would be deeply involved with the Lost Boys case and the rape case involving Brent Jeffs and his brothers. By the end of the year, Warren and I would be in each other's crosshairs. One evening during that time, as he was picking at dinner with some members of his large family, a wife approached and whispered into his ear. The prophet, looking angry, stopped eating. Another concerned wife at the table, hoping to console him, asked what the trouble was.
"It's that Gentile investigator, Sam Brower. He keeps popping up where he's not wanted,"
responded the prophet. Unfortunately, I learned a hard lesson during that first year that Warren Jeffs and his FLDS had remained all but invisible to outsiders. It was difficult to overstate what was going on in Short Creek, and it was equally impossible for anyone who had not been there to understand it. One result was that even the various investigations into Warren Jeffs and his FLDS were fragmented. Somehow, part of my task became building bridges between law enforcement and child protection agencies in several states, and between the locals and the federal authorities. That was a far cry from what I had originally signed on to do. But the farther along I went, the less choice I had. One of the capable investigators involved in this uncoordinated effort was Ron Barton from the office of Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. Barton had been doing a lot of digging, but he was hamstrung by orders to gather information without making waves. Nevertheless, he managed to pull together a lot of evidence of FLDS illegal practices, especially within the police department. But there seemed to be a lot of tension between Shurtleff and Barton, who left about the time I came on board. I originally had entertained high hopes for Shurtleff, who had an impressive record as a prosecutor before winning the attorney general position in 2001. Shurtleff is quick on his feet and had a strong law and order stance. Here was someone with the clout to get to the bottom of what was going on in the Crick. But when it came time to prosecute on Barton's hard work, the AG didn't follow through, which frustrated Barton into resigning. Barton was replaced by another state investigator, Jim Hill, who repeated the basic investigative exercise. Hill was in the middle of assembling more information when he, too, was reassigned off the FLDS case. He shortly thereafter quit the AG's office. I like Shurtleff. He is one of those guys that is hard to get mad at. But as the months progressed, I heard a lot more from the Attorney General in the press than I actually saw him doing. I eventually came to the realization that Shurtleff was no different from any other politician, trying to back his own agenda. When we needed AG help the most, he seemed to pull back from the sticky situation. No longer having a permanent home of his own, the Prophet was wearing ruts in the highways of the West with his secretive travels, living in motel rooms when on the road and not near a hideout. He had found a new place of refuge, which he codenamed R-23, in a forest some 4,600 feet above sea level in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and added it to his temporary nests. No matter where he was, Warren was constantly working, editing and recording his priesthood record dictations to his trusted Naomi, preaching back to the meeting house by telephone, undoing some marriages, performing new ones, judging letters of contrition, collecting money, and micromanaging decisions on the smallest day-to-day details of his flock and the various construction projects. Women chosen for the refuges were instructed to stay close to their buildings and not to shop in surrounding towns, even if that required making trips over hundreds of miles to distant stores. He always returned to Texas, where his masterpiece was being built. He traveled all over the ranch land and listened as the Lord filled in the temple's details for him. There would be four levels. A baptismal font would be placed in the basement, and the telestial floor on ground level would have light green flooring and seats. The carpet and chairs in the light blue second floor terrestrial floor would be linked by a staircase of white carpet to the all-white celestial top floor, with rooms for a school of the prophets. Warren secretly turned to the Internet to find out how the mainstream LDS church had designed its temples, and then he copied the results, saying they were God's special instructions to him. As the weeks passed, there were satisfying moments, such as when God decided on the kitchen tiles. There were also setbacks, as when Warren reported that the Lord rejected the materials for the drapes and sheer curtains upstairs. Apparently, no detail was too minor for divine scrutiny. The most shocking order came when Warren directed the building of a special bed to be used in temple rituals. He said that God revealed to him during one of his heavenly sessions that it would be a special table of strong hardwood that would be placed in the most sacred area of the temple, the Holy of Holies. His specific instructions, entered into his record, called for
a table on wheels that could be converted into a sturdy bed when the top was removed. On the right would be a cushioned prayer bench that could be folded away and hidden when not in use. The bed will be a size big enough for me to lay on it. It will be covered with a sheet, but it will have a plastic cover to protect the mattress from what will happen on it, and ropes.
A dozen chairs would surround it, and a podium would overlook it.
Something is going to happen in that room,
he predicted in his journal, then repeated it.
Something is going to happen in that room.
On the second day of March 2004, Warren picked out still two more children to become his wives, Mildred Millie Marlene Blackmore, age 13, and Annie Larie Jessup, who would not turn 15 for another week. Their fathers were Merrill Jessup, now a rising power in the FLDS, and Brandon Blackmore, one of the Canadians. The men probably had no objections since they were not expelled from the church, thus committing various felonies with their silence in handing their little girls over to the pedophile prophet. That night, Warren confessed to his scribe one reason for his compulsion to take immature brides.
These young girls have been given to me to be taught and trained how to come into the presence of God and help redeem Zion from their youngest years before they go through teenage doubting and boy troubles.
I will be their boy trouble and guide them right."
In other words, he could brainwash, mold, and molest them to his liking. Naomi was usually assigned the task of training the new girls in how a heavenly comfort wife should behave. Using language that a child could understand, she told them not to be afraid and to stand back in silence when their new husband went into a heavenly session, or more accurately, a revelation fit, which might consist of falling down and writhing on the floor, or might evolve into a sexual encounter with one or more of his heavenly comfort wives. At the end of March 2004, activist and child abuse opponent Flora Jessup telephoned El Dorado Success editor Randy Mankin and asked,
"Hey, do you know about that place being built in your area?"
The editor replied that he did and asked what she had heard. The conversation ended with Flora announcing that she was coming down to Texas to hold a news conference and reveal that Warren Jeffs and his Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were going to be the new occupants on that spread outside of town, the area's biggest construction project. Mankin ran a front-page story headlined, "Community Seeks Answers to Questions About New Neighbors." Nevertheless, David Allred, the official purchaser of the ranch property, stuck with a lie. He met with Sheriff Doran and a new face in the game, Texas Ranger Brooks Long, in the middle of April to assure them that it was indeed a corporate hunting retreat. But the busy editor Mankin tracked down longtime FLDS lawyer Rod Parker, who admitted that the compound was connected to the religion. As the story spread, the national media swarmed into tiny El Dorado. That spurred government agencies to demand inspections on what was obviously developing into a huge project. Warren thought it was outrageous that others might consider the impact beyond the fence lines, because he had set a deadline of June 27th for completion of a new building that would become an interim meeting house. He believed that once the FLDS was forced to get official permission for everything, the timetable would be out of God's hands. Still, a host of issues needed to be addressed, from tax assessment to the sewer system and a planned cement batch plant. And despite the lack of building codes, Texas is very picky about the possibility of sewage or chemical contaminants polluting the water table and spreading downstream. Sheriff Doran, Ranger Long, deputies, tax assessors, environmental protection agents, and other public officials were calling for a visit. Warren blamed his flock for the situation, complaining,
"We don't even have the faith to keep them away."
Finally, a party of government officials arrived and were allowed to see the orchard and the wheat field and the garden, the well and trailer homes. Everything but people. The sheriff asked where everyone was and was told that not many were around that day. Actually, dozens of Warren's children and wives were on site at the time, separated and hiding in upstairs rooms under firm orders to stay quiet. While traveling between Colorado and Texas on Saturday, April 24th, the prophet was given an update on the government visit, and he recognized that the ruse was over. There was no way to hide the obvious any longer. He hotly instructed his front men to lay it out and let the Texans know,
"We are there to stay."
4 days later, Allred met with Sheriff Doran and Justice of the Peace, Doyle, and admitted that the hunting lodge story had been false from the start. It had been needed, he said, to avoid media attention. The compound would only have about 200 residents, he promised. That was a lie, too. Chapter 20. On the Run. Warren Jeffs' paranoia spiked sharply after the discovery of his hoax in Texas, and it wound him even tighter. He was convinced that hired assassins were out to kill him. The pressure was relentless. Things had not gone well with building the refuges during the severe bad weather in the winter of 2004, as ice and snow and hard winds delayed both work and travel.
It had cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a month to maintain the workers and their families. Legal bills in excess of $100,000 had been incurred on matters ranging from property issues to court hearings to setting up holding companies. The prophet was feeling a financial pinch, with a lot more work yet to be done. Although some of his closest allies already carried debts of several hundred thousand dollars, Jeffs instructed every adult male FLDS member to cough up a consecration donation of $1,000 per month, a staggering sum for people who had little money. He also ordered each family to halt construction on their own homes and give the church any future funds they would otherwise spend on their own place. All of that came on top of the minimum 10% of each member's gross income that they were expected to hand over as a tithe each month. Also, Warren had banned Sunday meetings because the people were too slothful and no longer deserved the blessings of the sacrament, and there were not going to be any more Saturday work projects on individual homes, so the people were ordered to work weekends and take those extra earnings and consecrate them to the church as well. This produced an immediate improvement in the cash flow, but soon he would also be trying to sell off hundreds of acres of FLDS-owned lands elsewhere and shuffling those funds into paying the bills for his refuges. Worse, to him, was that everything and everyone was falling short of the Lord's schedule. He became even more demanding, ordering the builders at all of the refuge sites to work 20 hours a day and pray for the strength to work 24. Men and women should not mingle. All of them were placed under divine condemnation for their laziness and lack of faith. He carefully chose who was good enough to work on the projects, picking from among the best qualified in Short Creek. Not everyone was going to make it to Zion, and he moaned that the cut would be deep. Even the children in Texas were not measuring up to his standards.
"We have brought Babylon here in the form of toys, selfish toys, where children, they live to please themselves, the dolls, the trucks, all those are idols," he said.
Every family had to search out all toys and either discard or burn them.
"Instead of a doll, a child can learn how to hold a real baby," he concluded.
Warren had what he considered an important dream on a Sunday morning in April 2004. He saw a Navy admiral tempting his people with trinkets and dolls and goods from all over the world. His ladies decorated themselves and tried to lure him into socializing. In his dream, Warren just wanted to leave that dreadful place.
"All I could find was a little scooter, a little motorcycle. I got on it and started driving away,"
the record states. But he was stopped in his dream by a policewoman.
"Over the simple excuse that I didn't have a taillight on my motorcycle. My little scooter."
Warren read the episode as heavenly guidance to make certain that all vehicles were in perfect order, so he would not be stopped for some minor infraction. After that, he tightened his road security, traveling with a lead car a mile ahead of him, and often with a trail car, the vehicle staying in contact by radio. They did not exceed the speed limit. The goal was to not be stopped. But if they were, the drivers could not identify themselves as being a Jeffs or an Allred. The little things could be dangerous. His entourage of Naomi, the drivers, and the bodyguards would therefore wear disguises of normal Gentile clothing, which would allow them to mix among the people of the world when they traveled. Naomi still wore a prairie dress over her jeans if they were in an FLDS community or refuge, but she took it off once they were on the road. If other wives came on a trip, they also would be disguised. Having established these rules of the road, Warren Jeffs plunged even deeper into hiding. As the summer of 2004 arrived, the prophet decided to have a reunion with 40 of his wives who still remained in Short Creek and all of their children. Since the Lord had told him that the dying community was no longer safe for him to visit for any length of time, he arranged a rendezvous in a secluded campground of the Kaibab National Forest on the edge of the north rim of the Grand Canyon in Arizona. The geography made secrecy easy, but the family gathering backfired. Individual wives and kids who had not seen their husband and father for so long competed for the opportunity to get some personal time with him, to go for private walks in the pine forests, and confide their feelings to him. It made Warren uncomfortable. According to his dictations, the hugs and kisses and private notes and photographs were somehow distasteful, and his approval went out only to a few who stayed apart, praying in heavenly light, instead of pestering him with selfish desires. When the outdoor get-together was finished, he fell into a dour mood. He felt few in his family were prepared. Afterward, it was back to the despair of Short Creek for the family members. For Warren, it was time for another road trip. He was off on a warm weather journey back to Jackson County, Missouri, to once again visit the early Mormon sites, this time without being hampered by snow and freezing temperatures. He considered the area to be not only a sacred site, but one that had been promised to him by God. He prophesied that after God's judgments devoured the land and the wicked, the righteous FLDS members who remained would resettle there to construct his ultimate project, the final temple. The ranch that was blooming in Texas was merely a step toward that dream, an interim place where his people could learn to build a proper temple. Its official name would reflect that unfinished step, and it became the Yearning for Zion Ranch. One of the sites Jeff's visited on his trip was the domed state capitol building in Jefferson City, where he strolled through the office of the governor and both chambers of the General Assembly. As he gazed at the statues of Thomas Jefferson, Meriwether Lewis, and William Clark, he could not contain his inner fury at such brazen idols. He found an unoccupied room, went in, and performed a ritualistic curse he termed kicking the dust from his feet, calling for the lawmakers and all of the citizens of Missouri to be swept from the face of the earth. His new Zion would need the space. Waco was on everybody's mind when I made my initial visit to Texas in September. In that infamous 1993 bloody standoff between the federal government and the Branch Davidian religious cult, 54 adults and 21 children had died. Waco is only a two-hour drive to the east from El Dorado, and the shadow of Branch Davidian's maniacal prophet, David Koresh, easily stretched to the YFZ ranch, where another prophet was gathering a fervent band of followers of his own. I had been monitoring and trying to make sense of Warren's hideout scheme, and the rumor was that he was in Texas. So after the Brent Jeffs rape case was filed on August 5th, I decided to see for myself. I flew into nearby San Angelo on September 4th, got a hotel room, then drove directly over to El Dorado, and started digging for information and meeting people who I hoped would be beneficial to our cases in the months to come. My first stop was the office of the El Dorado Success newspaper, where I found editor Randy Mankin eager to share information. We enjoyed a steak dinner, then got into his truck and drove out to the site. Night had fallen, a wide canopied western blackness, but a bubble of distant lights marked the ranch. They were working around the clock. Randy pulled up beside the wire fence that surrounded the property, and I got out. Although the work was too far off the road to be seen, I could feel the ground quaking from the movement of heavy equipment at the site. "It's like this every night," Mankin said. "The only way to really see the place is to fly over it." The following morning, I contacted Sheriff David Doran and told him that I had papers to serve on Warren Jeffs. I found him to be someone who liked to stay on top of what was going on in his county, and if someone new rolled into town, he would want to know about it. He agreed to help, and we drove back out to the ranch in his truck. There was not much more to see in the daylight than there had been at night. Everything was far away, but I could still hear construction going on. Doran dialed a number, and soon the new head man at the ranch, Bishop Merrill Jessup, came out to the old cattle fence beside the road. He was buttoned up and wore an old-fashioned brown straw hat. I stayed in the truck and let Doran talk to him first. The sheriff had been working hard to establish a cordial relationship with his secretive religious group that had turned up on his doorstep, and he felt it important to try and keep the lines of communication open as much as possible. He had visited Short Creek back in May and had come away with the clear understanding the FLDS was not going to compromise, and Doran was still trying to figure out what kind of trouble that might cause. The sheriff had no proof of any wrongdoing at the ranch. Finally, Doran called me over. We went through the subpoena delivery routine that had become so familiar to me by now. I asked if Warren was there. Jessup lied, saying no. Warren wasn't there and hadn't been seen or heard from for months. Then I handed him the papers, and the bishop said he could not take them. The sheriff interjected that under Texas law, he had to accept service. Jessup reluctantly did so, insisting that he wouldn't be seeing Warren Jeffs anytime soon, so that it would be impossible to get the papers to him. Still, it was an important first step. It was necessary to show that all reasonable attempts had been made to serve Jeffs so that the court could proceed with the lawsuit, with or without the prophet's cooperation. Those papers gave Warren Jeffs only 20 days to answer them. I still had not seen beyond the wire fence, so my next contact was with Justice of the Peace, Jimmy Doyle, who regularly flew over the ranch. He invited me up in his 4-seat airplane. The ranch was landlocked, and it was outlined by a 5-foot-high wire field fence. I readied my camera as we approached, and the actual construction site came into view. It was a lot larger than I had expected, although still unfinished and with plenty of room to expand. A tiny guard shack was at the bend in the road leading to the main entrance, and beyond it, a network of good roads snaked out to various parts of the property. The biggest operation was a cement plant, with a silo sticking up like a rocket from the flatland, and atop it sat a doghouse-like guard post. As I flew over taking photos of their security setup, I peered through the camera at some guy perched on the landing of the silo staring back at me through a pair of binoculars. Some large living quarters were well underway, and some industrial-style buildings were complete. Work had also begun on a large meeting house on the center of the property. Doyle pointed out one construction site as a commissary, which I knew would be the bishop's storehouse. There was no sign of any temple. The only greenery was the heat-loving mesquite and scrub brush, and much of that was being cleared for future building sites. Machinery and building materials were down there, but where were the people? I would learn later that at the first sound of an aircraft, they would scatter inside or hide under the porch overhangs on the houses. That evening, I went back out to the compound on my own. I had seen some wires leading from the exterior fence and wanted to determine if they had installed cameras for extra security, and if so, were they to keep people out or to keep people in? When darkness fell, I shined the infrared light from my own camera on the wires and followed them to the power source, a car battery. As far as I could tell, the FLDS had cameras watching every foot of their ranch. Perhaps they were able to see me, but there was no reaction. On the way back to Utah, I mulled over what I had found out. A large and isolated hideout, tight security, dodging the law. It all brought to mind what other fanatics like Jim Jones and David Koresh had done. In fact, Warren Jeffs had more followers and more money than either Jones or Koresh. His followers did not cling to him just because of personal charisma. They had been born and bred into the FLDS and had little understanding of the outside world. They would do whatever was required to defend their God his prophet Warren, and their way of life. I feared things were headed in a bad direction. Just after I got back from Texas, the Chatwin family feud erupted again. Ross Chatwin had grown weary of his brother Stephen living upstairs and had asked my advice on how to get rid of his unwanted tenant and relative, who had been installed in his home by the FLDS. There was no question that the house was Ross's. The life estate decision specified the entire house belonged to him for his lifetime. But the prophet remained angry about it and had been hounding the United Effort Plan lawyers to find a loophole. In desperation, the UEP flipped the unjust enrichment argument that had given Ross the victory and now claimed that Ross could not take possession of the second floor without first paying Stephen some $23,000 for improvements that Stephen had made on the small and blocky blue-gray house. The claim was bogus. It was the church's work crew, and not Stephen, who had made those unwanted, unauthorized, and illegal changes, and they had been made under protest of the home's true legal occupant. Instead of obeying the law, the FLDS had relaunched the matter as a new civil case. It had become rather silly. The original tenant of the UEP-owned property, the Chatwin's mutual brother, David, had gone away and was now following Winston Blackmore in Canada, a situation that further fueled Warren's ire. Any friend of Winston's would be considered an enemy by Warren. I advised Ross to talk to a lawyer before doing anything, and a strategy was put together in which Ross posted eviction notices on the upstairs door for several weeks. Those warnings were ignored and torn down. So on September 7th, when Stephen left the house, Ross slithered through an upstairs window and changed the locks. Stephen, unable to open the doors, called the Short Creek police, and officers Helaman Barlow and Fred Barlow showed up asking to see the court documents. Having already been through a similar exercise back when Chief Sam Roundy had simply ignored the documents, Ross demanded that his attorney be present before handing anything over. When he refused to change back the locks, the officers charged him with criminal trespass, cuffed him, and hauled him to jail. Stephen Chatwin then climbed through the same window that Ross had used and reinstalled the old locks. Lori Chatwin had recorded the entire episode on a video camera, and she called me while I was in the middle of a dinner meeting at the home of attorney Pat Shea in Salt Lake City. I could not break away, but I told her the audacious arrest would not stand. The following day, Mojave County authorities read the life estate ruling of Judge Chavez and dismissed the criminal charge. Ross was once again a free man. Stephen begged the prophet to let him move out of the house and get away from his apostate brother. He said when he was listening to Warren's recorded sermons upstairs on Saturday mornings, Ross would turn up his television set downstairs so loudly while his kids watched cartoons that Stephen felt his family was being corrupted by Ross's evil ways. When one of Ross's grandmothers died, he tried to attend her funeral at the meeting house. But Willie Jessup and other church security men were posted at the door to make sure no apostates were allowed inside to defile the service. Ross and his family were turned away. He decided he would at least attend the graveside services to pay his last respects, and he took along his video camera to record the event for other family members. Willie Jessup was on guard there, too. He walked up to Ross and snatched the camera, shoving Ross away. But Ross was becoming adept at sticking up for himself, so he not only called the local police, who he knew would do absolutely nothing, but he also called the Mojave County Sheriff's Office and filed a theft charge regarding the camera. Within an hour, Willie was knocking at Ross's door, camera in hand, red-faced in embarrassment, and too mad to talk. Willie handed the camera over and left without a word. Several months later, in April 2005, Stephen and his family were allowed to move out, and Ross Chatwin's house finally became his own. Chapter 21, Moncos. As the fall of 2004 approached, I was trying to pick up the scent of the runaway prophet. It was laborious and painstaking work, but I had polished my investigative teeth as a bounty hunter. There are times to sit behind a desk and times to hit the pavement. This was desk time, and I spent hours combing through special computer databases available only to investigators and law enforcement. I would feed in names of the FLDS hierarchy and dates and license plates and other scraps of information and see what came back. Hundreds, even thousands of hits might pour in, leaving me with the mundane task of eliminating useless data. It is not exciting work, but it is effective. The piece of information that can't be discarded is usually the piece that fits the puzzle. Such was the case when I ran the name of David Allred, the original buyer of the property in Texas. An avalanche of hits came back. There were a lot of David Allreds out there in cyberspace, most of them having nothing to do with the FLDS. But as I began chipping away at it over the next couple of days, the stack became more manageable, and late one night, an interesting connection popped up. Allred had a company called Sherwood Management, which had been incorporated in Nevada, a state notorious for allowing corporations anchored there to hide their officers and shield assets from prying eyes. Sherwood was cross-indexed to a piece of property that had been bought 6 miles north of the isolated little mountain village called Moncos, located in the sparsely populated Four Corners area of southwestern Colorado. I considered the equation. David Steed Allred, a confirmed FLDS money man, had been the one to establish the hunting lodge foothold in Texas. Allred and Sherwood were tied to the purchase of a pair of 60-acre lots near Moncos for $1,394,000. It was time to get out from behind the desk and hit the road. I gassed up and headed east. I had a feeling that I might need some backup on this trip, so I called John Krakauer at his home in Colorado. We had made telephone contact several months earlier, and I had grown comfortable talking with him. His book, Under the Banner of Heaven, had already been published, and he had no intention of writing anything more about the FLDS. But his disdain for some of the group's despicable practices had remained, and he was fierce about wanting to help. He, too, wanted some answers, and he did not hesitate when I invited him to join me in Moncos. We arrived at a hotel in nearby Cortez simultaneously, and actually met for the first time in a hallway while walking to our rooms. John has piercing eyes and is of medium build, and he is physically fit from a lifetime of mountaineering and other hard exercise. It would be useful to have someone who knew so much about the case who could also watch my back. Over dinner, we joked that if the FLDS were to come upon us prowling around the Moncos compound, we might find ourselves under the next foundation they poured in Texas. Before doing anything, we had to deal with a media leak that could jeopardize our plans. Flora Jessup had happened to call during one of my late-night research sessions on Allred, and I had made an offhand comment to her about the interesting data coming back concerning a little Colorado town. While trying to develop more information on her own, she had passed the discovery to a reporter in Phoenix. I am particularly wary about allowing the media into my investigations. Reporters are not paid to keep secrets. Some journalists had earned my trust, others had not. I had never met the guy Flora had contacted, so he was in the latter category. He planned to broadcast a story right away, which could have torpedoed our whole plan, so John tried to make a deal with him. If he would hold off for 48 hours, we would give him exclusive access to everything we had discovered, and Krakauer, who rarely gives media interviews, would sit down and talk to him on camera. "Just give us time to get there and look around," we asked, "and perhaps serve papers on Warren Jeffs." Then the reporter would be able to break the even bigger story with a famous author on the subject answering all questions. It was more than fair. In fact, it was a no-brainer. The reporter said he would talk to his producer. When he got back to us, he said a